KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, the punditocracy has been arguing that the guilty verdicts in the Trump trial won't matter much in the election. Mark Cooper disagrees. He'll explain why. Also, Jordan Peterson's books of advice for men have sold 5 million copies. He says men should work hard, be responsible, and make their beds. Katha Pollitt will comment. But first, what happened to the immediate Gaza ceasefire that Biden called for last week? For comment, we turn to Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of the American Prospect. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, last Wednesday, Israel's national security advisor said that he expected Israel's war on Gaza would continue at least to the end of the year, if not longer. That means Israel would be, you know, committing more war crimes, more crimes against humanity, killing thousands more Palestinians. And in terms of American politics, nowhere near as serious as what's happening in Gaza, but of special interest to us. What does continuing the war till the end of the year or beyond it mean for American campuses when the fall term begins?
Well, if that's still going on, and if administration policy is still essentially what it is today, I suspect that will the fall will make the spring look like a kind of small dress rehearsal by comparison.
So more students arrested, more students kicked out. What do we have? Something like 130 campuses had encampments. You would expect more, lots more.
I would expect more, and I would expect this to be a major story in the media right during the immediate run-up to the November elections.
Now, Biden, of course, knows about this. Biden, of course, has been thinking about this. Remind us what his response was to that Israeli announcement that their war against the people of Gaza would continue at least until the end of the year.
Well, he on Friday announced that he had taken apparently something that had emerged as an Israeli proposal to have a ceasefire and had concluded that we had already reached the point where it was no longer possible for Hamas to stage any significant terror attacks on Israelis, and therefore called on both sides to adopt this ceasefire proposal. But that wasn't the end of the story.
What? And what did Bibi say when Biden announced this is the Israeli proposal which he wanted Hamas to accept?
Well, essentially, Biden sort of outed the proposal, which came as a surprise to the two very far-right settler and ultra-Orthodox members of Bibi's cabinet, who were there because they have told Bibi they will keep the government in power so long as he kowtows to their demands. And so Bibi essentially kowtowed to their demands and essentially repudiated the document that Biden had alluded to.
Netanyahu basically made it clear that he has no interest in stopping the war on Gaza until, he says, until Hamas is totally eliminated, which we understand to mean never. Critics of Netanyahu's war strategy have argued since the beginning that he has no strategy for after the war, no idea about how Gaza should be governed, by whom. Now it seems like we see why. He doesn't want the war to end. He wants a continual state of war in Gaza, and Joe Biden knows that too. And Joe Biden offered an explanation for why Bibi was rejecting a ceasefire proposal. What was his explanation?
Well, he, in an interview he gave to Time magazine, he said Bibi wanted to cling to power, and keeping the war going was one way to do that. And that clinging to power, of course, was the way Bibi could avoid a conviction in criminal proceedings for accepting bribes that are wending their way through the Israeli courts.
Yeah. So as soon as there's a ceasefire, then there'll be a proposal to hold new elections in Israel. There will be investigations of the causes of the security failures that led to October 7th. They will find that Bibi was mostly responsible. He will no longer hold office. Then his trial and criminal charges will proceed. Then he might go to prison. Sort of like the United States, actually, a presidential candidate who might go to prison unless he gets reelected.
Sort of like. There, you know, you could definitely draw some parallels there.
For political reasons, Joe Biden needs a ceasefire soon, before, at least before the fall campaign begins. We usually think of Labor Day as the beginning of the real campaign. And Bibi wants the war to end never. Biden doesn't seem to hold the cards here.
Well, Biden holds some cards that he is yet to play, in particular, continuing U.S. aid to the Israeli military, other than purely defense of anti-missile systems. And that he has not played. And since that's really the only thing he can do, I think, that would not only deter a lot of the left from the kind of outrage and the demonstrations that follow from that, but that would also, you know, ease the anxieties of the center left, which are not too crazy about Biden's approach to Israel, and also fear its consequences for the November elections.
Of course, there's another war that Biden is implicated in, Ukraine, which began with Putin's invasion, which was in February 2022. The United States, of course, has provided the lion's share of the arms and intelligence that have enabled Ukraine to keep fighting. But nevertheless, Ukraine has been slowly losing ground. Why is that?
Well, I mean, there's a fundamental asymmetry here. And the fundamental asymmetry is there are four Russians for every one Ukrainian. And when it becomes a war of attrition, which is pretty much what it has become, we can arm Ukraine, and I've supported our efforts to arm Ukraine. But ultimately, really, the one thing we can't do and don't want to do, and I don't think anyone has proposed we do it, is actually send troops to even up the counts on the battlefield. When you're outnumbered, also, I should add, Russia has been, if you look at World War I, if you look at World War II, historically rather indifferent to a high casualty rate, knowing in both those conflicts, and certainly in the current one, that it had bodies to spare, as it were, that the other side did not. Russia can keep doing that. And that is a real problem for Ukraine, because if we talked about the absence of a day after plan that the Israeli government has vis-a-vis Gaza, it's kind of hard to see a day after plan in Ukraine that ultimately doesn't involve coming to some kind of settlement by which Russia can hang on to most of the territory that they currently occupy, and unfortunately that they're increasing their occupation of.
You argued recently at the prospect that it's in Ukraine's interest to call an end to the war now. What's your reasoning there?
Well, because at the moment they have lost some territories that they haven't actually controlled for a long time in the Donbass Basin and so on, and, you know, some more territory as well. But my fear is that the longer the war goes on, the more territory Russia will control and the less territory Ukraine will control. I mean, so that's my thinking. That doesn't mean it's politically possible.
Well, let's look at that for a minute. Does that mean Biden should call for a ceasefire in negotiations now between Ukraine and Russia, the way he's proposing a ceasefire in negotiations between Israel and Hamas?
Well, Biden has also said from the outset that it's up to Ukraine to determine, its own fate. And I think that's an inherently correct position. And clearly, Ukraine has not reached the point where that's what that's the policy it would now embrace.
It takes two sides to agree. We've talked here about Ukraine. Do you think Putin would agree to end the war, say, if he got two eastern provinces of Ukraine becoming Russian along with Crimea?
That is a very good question. If he interprets it as a sign of Ukrainian collapse, he would probably keep going. Putin might insist, and you know, I think this is a reasonable expectation, that some sweeteners be thrown into the pot, certainly the lifting of sanctions on Russia that were imposed at the outset of his attack on Ukraine. Also a pledge that Ukraine not be admitted into NATO. In this situation, inherently, he would hold more cards than Ukraine would. And on top of the very act of going for a ceasefire, that would be a problem for the Ukrainian government, but it might also be a problem for the Baltic states and for Poland that border on Russia. So, you know, this is not an easy thing to untangle, and it's not clear to me that this is a Gordian knot that can be cut.
Okay, so much for the Gordian knots in Gaza and in Ukraine. Let's talk about something else, the border with Mexico. Biden has basically conceded to the Republicans on border policy and adopted something like Trump's approach. The administration will shut off asylum for the overwhelming majority of people arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. No asylum seekers permitted when the average border arrests surpass 2,500 for 7 days in a row. Now, 7 days, we're already at 7 days. We've had 7 days in a row. The Biden rule also raises the legal bar for an asylum claim at the border from the reasonable possibility that the migrant will face torture at home to a reasonable probability. And it says that we will reopen asylum only when the number of weekly arrests declines to 1,500, which it has not done for most of the last 9 years. The ACLU says Biden's new border policy will send people in need of protection to their deaths. The ACLU said it will go to court to stop that policy. Amy Fisher, she's the director of refugee and migrant rights at Amnesty International USA, she said Biden's action, quote, plays into false narratives about an invasion at the border and advances a policy grounded in white supremacist ideas at the expense of people in search of safety in the United States. I think we agree with that. So no more give me your huddled masses yearning to be free. It's obviously a political move to get more votes for Biden. Will it work? Will it help him win Arizona?
Well, we should note that a leading member of the Progressive Caucus, Ruben Gallego, who is running for the Democratic candidate for Senate in Arizona, is basically supported Biden's statement because he sees there's, you know, that would be the greatest liability leading to his defeat and the election of a right-wing nut job if he didn't support it. We kind of know Biden's own politics on this because he when he was out of office, he opposed Trump imposing similar restrictions back in 2018. So I think that's what Biden would like to do, all else being equal. It's clear from every poll that the public perception that under Biden, the border has gotten out of control is one of his two greatest electoral vulnerabilities, the other being the high price of lots of essentials. Clearly, that is what he is responding to, you know, and it's, let's put it this way, this was a real dilemma for them. I mean, he could have done this at any time earlier during his presidency. He didn't. I think he feels that the necessity of his winning and keeping Donald Trump out of the White House compelled him to do it now.
So we've had a lot of bad news today from Gaza, from Ukraine, from the Mexican border, but we do have good news. The Republican candidate for president is still a convicted felon. A Morning Consult poll shows that 54% of registered voters approved of the 34 guilty verdicts? Well, only 34% disapproved. A third. That's basically Trump's base, nobody else. Worse for Trump, 49% of independents said he should end his campaign because he's a convicted felon. 15% of Republicans said the same thing in the Morning Consult poll. Second poll just came out, a Reuters Ipsos poll found that 10% of registered Republican voters said his conviction made it less likely they would vote for him. 25% of independents said his conviction made it less likely that they would vote for him. Of course, we don't think that many Republicans and independents will refuse to vote for him. But if the numbers are half of that, if they're a quarter of that, say he loses 2 or 3% of Republicans and 6 or 7% of independents, he can't be elected. Have I got that right?
Possibly. But keep in mind, to say that you won't vote for him is not the same thing as saying you will vote for Joe Biden. There's RFK Jr. There's skipping the presidential line on the ballot. So I wouldn't, you know, get ecstatic about these poll results yet. There's a long way to go. And I don't think these necessarily foretell the defeat of Donald Trump, unfortunately.
But it is a fact that if you get fewer votes, you're less likely to be elected president.
That is indubitably true, although the whole notion of the Electoral College kind of says, well, maybe.
It has to be in the right states.
Yes.
It has to be in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, yeah. Arizona, Georgia, and what am I leaving out? Nevada. How could I leave out Nevada?
Nevada and North Carolina.
And North Carolina. However, if he wins Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, he's got the 270 he needs to win.
Biden, yes, that's true.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Thank you, Harold. Always great to have you on the show.
And always great to be here, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. The punditocracy says Trump's guilty verdicts won't matter much to voters. Mark Cooper disagrees. He's a reporter whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, Harper's, The New Yorker, Playboy, Rolling Stone, The LA Times, The Village Voice, The LA Weekly, and The Nation. He also taught journalism at USC, and his terrific weekly column, The Coop Scoop, appears at Substack. Mark Cooper, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that the convictions don't matter because everybody already knew everything about the Stormy Daniels payoff. It's old news. In fact, everybody already knew what they thought about Trump long before this
right.
trial and these verdicts. They've been watching him for 8 years. They're either for him or against him, and neither side is going to change their minds because of this. Yeah. What do you say?
Well, I'd say that the pundits also told us that the case against Trump was very weak, that it was going to be difficult to prosecute, that the jury would never be able to understand the upgrade of the misdemeanors into felonies. It would be a sideshow that nobody cared about. The only part the pundits write about is that, fortunately for Mr. Trump, this was not televised. If this had been televised, everybody would have been watching it every day. So the amount of people actually followed this is small, I think, relatively. But, you know, people get their news in a fragmentary way, most people. They don't do it the way we see it on cable TV, where you got four experts who sit around and say, well, on the 11th minute of the testimony, he said this and it meant that. They get fragments of all of the Trump scandals, if you will, of all of the Trump eruptions. I think this one is probably broken through more than others. And what's broken through is Trump was convicted of 34 felonies. People may not know what they are. or why or what, but that's the one sentence that's getting through the ether.
Some people argue that, yes, that is getting through the ether, but the convictions may help Trump more than they will hurt him. Well, Brett Stevens wrote this in the New York Times on Tuesday. Let me quote Brett Stevens. Trump fiddled with the books 7 years ago to cover up a tawdry affair from more than a decade earlier. He got convicted in a case brought by a progressive prosecutor in a liberal jurisdiction through an obscure law. The verdict plays into Trump's argument that the system is out to get him, close quote. So this makes him even more of an outsider and a rebel, which will boost the turnout of his base, especially the resentful young working class white men. You call them the white men pickup truck faction.
Well, all I have to say is that have some sympathy for Brett Stevens. He's got a column that he has to fill. And he has to fill it with something. This is really a filler. He has no idea. And frankly, I don't either. All I have is common sense. What we've seen so far is the following. In the primary period of the last 3 or 4 months, roughly 30% of Republicans don't want to vote for Donald Trump. And they're looking to put their vote somewhere. They put it with Nikki Haley, and now she's with Trump. Ta-da! What a surprise. Do I think that 30% of Republicans are not going to vote for Trump? No, I don't think that. But here's what I do think. I think it defies all human logic to think that somebody who's already thrown the country into turmoil, whether you supported him or not, he's an agent of chaos. Here's somebody who's mentally and physically and emotionally exhausted the country for the last 9 years, literally. Here's somebody who is in a clear state of mental impairment. He's not the same he was even 4 years ago. He's in trouble upstairs, big time. And you're going to tell me that somebody like that, who's got 34 felony convictions, who's still facing 3 more criminal trials, who's already lost 2 of the biggest civil trials in recent history, is somebody who's going to be elected president of the United States? Well, he was elected in 2016. That's true. But in 2016, he was a clown. He was a clown with a nasty edge to him. That's not who he is today. Today, he's a bitter, nasty, resentful downer. He hates America. He's into his American carnage mode. Everything is terrible. Everything is awful. And those kind of candidates never win. The candidates who win presidential elections are optimistic ones.
Well, another argument made by pundits is that these convictions are insignificant because January 6th is his real crime, trying to overturn the election results. This was at the New Yorker. Alex Shepard called the verdicts disappointing. He said all of the investigations, grand juries, impeachments, indictments have culminated in this, the Stormy Daniels payoff. He said this is insignificant.
All of this did not lead to that. There's a lot of this that's still going on, and this was the first one to come to a head. The big bone I would pick here is with Merrick Garland. I think Merrick Garland blew the first 18 months of this administration by sitting on his hands and doing nothing about the upper echelons of the Trump administration that was neck deep into January 6th. He did nothing about it until he was forced to by the congressional hearing. That's what's pushed all of this right up against the election. Now, if Trump wins the election, and I will definitely grant that's a possibility. He might win. I don't think so, but he might. If he wins, then all of this means nothing. And he's home free, probably, though 2 of his trials are state trials, and they're not that easy to quash. The worst thing is he'll be convicted in the state trials and he'll be sentenced to serve when he's 83 and dead. Okay. Look, it was nobody's decision for this case to go first. This case was the least significant of them all, but it was still highly significant. I'm going to say why. Charges were not as dramatic as the ones that are in the other cases, but the process revealed a Donald Trump that we kind of knew was there, but not to this depth. I mean, we really saw this guy for the last number of weeks, and it was not a pretty picture. And it revealed him at the top of a conspiracy with the National Enquirer to buy and suppress information. It's quite serious when you're dealing with an election. The evidence in this case is very clear, what this guy did. And it's not as serious as what he did on January 6th, but is there some rule that you have to prosecute in descending order?
Yeah, and it may be that this payoff to Stormy Daniels, quashing her story right after the Excess Hollywood tape came out, it may be this was the little bit that helped get him those last few electoral votes that made him president.
It's certainly possible. All we know is that that's what he was trying to do. And he was trying to do it in a corrupt and illegal way. If he loses the election, this is what it's going to be the rest of his life.
Yeah.
So his life is going to be spent in courtrooms and appeals.
Couple more of the arguments out there from our friends in the punditocracy. And these are about sort of what the Democratic strategy should be with this background. A lot of our friends argue if the Democrats want to win, it's a mistake to talk about Trump as a convicted felon. They need to focus on what Trump would do if reelected, on the future, not on what he did 7 years ago. And for a lot of voters, what's important to them is the rising cost of essentials like food and housing. Trump's conviction isn't going to shift those voters' concerns. So it's important not to talk about the convictions that make him a felon. It's important to talk about what he would do as president as opposed to what Biden would continue doing as president.
I laugh because none of that describes how that happens. What is it about talking trash about Trump now? What is it about that causes a decrease in the vote for Biden? I don't understand. And the other thing is this. You can do both those things. You can talk about the past and the future. And to talk about what a Trump administration would be like, here's the word I'm going to use. The character of a president is very important. And that's what's made Trump so repulsive to so many people, not just his policies. I don't even know what his policies are. He's a repulsive person.
Yeah,
and he would be repulsive under any circumstances, but I don't want to sound like goody two-shoes here, but we like to think of our president as being somebody who, you know, is not that embarrassing.
Right? Nice way
and,
of putting
and,
it.
And both these guys have their problems in that regard. But Trump's character, this trial, put his character on garish display for 2 months.
And let me add one thing to that. The effect of the verdicts on Trump will be to exaggerate and increase all his worst qualities as a campaigner.
I'm going to suppose the following. We've already seen that this sentence did not push 3 million people into the street demanding that, you know,
He withdraw from the race.
Right, which could have happened somewhere else, possibly. Okay, so there was not some immediate massive reaction. What I think there is there's a very quiet, small crack in the hull of the battleship, and the oil is leaking out a little bit at a time. And that leak's going to open up over the next few weeks and over the next months. He's not going to lose support among his base. his base was not going to grow because of this. His base will be motivated by this, but they're already motivated. It doesn't matter. They don't need this to be motivated. You're not going to tell me that a person under these circumstances is going to get more votes rather than less. It doesn't make any sense. It's just not going to happen. Trump, in order to win, is going to need the swing vote in those swing states. He's going to need those nice suburban ladies from your state in Minnesota to vote for him, and the nice suburban ladies in Virginia and in Wisconsin and Michigan. And he's doing everything he can right now to alienate them. If he loses, forget about losing 30% of the Republicans to the Nikki Haley voters, whoever they were. He can't afford to lose 3%, which I will guarantee you he has already lost.
Well, right? This is another argument that we are told. Okay, so some Republicans, suburban women especially, will not vote for him now because of the verdicts, but that doesn't mean they will vote for Biden. They might vote for a third party. They might not vote at all. What do you say to that?
This all comes from Democratic bedwetters, right? People who spend all night worrying about this could happen, that could happen. Yeah, that could happen. That's right. That could happen. We haven't talked about Bobby Kennedy either, right? I want to be clear. I am not saying that Donald Trump has definitively lost the election. What I'm saying is that he's probably lost the election because of these convictions and what's going to come after that.
And if fewer people vote for him, he's less likely to be elected.
Of course. Of course. Someone sit there and say, oh, yeah, this guy's in a great position now. He's going to really be getting a lot more votes. No, he's not. That's not true. It's not true. It's not going to happen. You don't get more votes by being indicted and facing prison and being exposed to somebody who's running this current incredible conspiracy to suppress information about your sordid personal life.
One last piece of pundit wisdom, my favorite piece. It doesn't matter what people say now about Trump being found guilty of 43 felonies. The real verdict will be how people vote on November 5th, and so it's too soon to tell.
Well, yeah, that's a good line. A journalist would use that line. It's too early to tell, John, you know? That's what you just said is, everything you just said is true. That's right. It's too early to tell. We'll know on election day for sure. I think, maybe, right? That's the other thing is, we're thinking only about who's going to win. How about who loses? What happens when Trump loses? And what's that going to look like? It's not going to be that much fun. I think you actually said the most important thing in our short conversation today. And I'm glad you said it because I overlooked it. The way it's affecting him is very important. He's already, I was being funny about it, but he's clearly got a bad case of impairment going on. He's missing a lot of words. He's missing a lot of sentences. He's freezing up. He's slurring. But apart from that, he's out of his mind and very extreme and doing a great job of alienating exactly those people he needs to win.
Mark Cooper, his column, The Coop Scoop, appears at Substack. Mark, thank you. You're really good at this.
Thank you.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Now it's time to talk with Katha Pollitt about advice for men. Katha, of course, is an award-winning poet, essayist, and columnist for The Nation. We reached her today at home in New York. Hi, Katha.
Hi, John.
Well, when I saw that your new column is about Jordan Peterson, I immediately had a question. Who is he?
You're not alone. My friends are so out of it. They all had the same response. Who? What are you talking about? Jordan Peterson is immensely famous. His first book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, sold 5 million copies. I don't think you and I together sold even half of that. Okay. And it's slated for translation into 50 languages. But even more impressive than that, because a lot of people can buy a book and then, as you know, not read it, his YouTube channel has, get this, 3.68 million subscribers.
So you say these best-selling books are crammed with references to Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, the Bible, Jesus, and Jung. We're talking about big-time thinkers here. But what is the message that he finds in all these big-time thinkers? You say it's men should work hard, be responsible, and make your bed. Not sure that's really what Jesus said. Or Dostoevsky, but Katha, what's wrong with saying men should be responsible? Isn't that what you want too?
Well, don't forget the ancient Mesopotamian deities and Isis and Osiris, who also were probably not too big on making their beds, and figure significantly in this book. And we should mention he's the reason I wrote about him is there's a new volume.
Yes. More rules.
12 more rules for life. I think this book, the kind way of speaking about it, is that it does speak to a great confusion that many men feel. They want to get with the program, but they don't really know how to do it. And they want a purpose in life, and they don't have one. And of course, women want a purpose in life, too. But they're not, fewer of them are going to Jordan Peterson for that. He's also quite anti-feminist.
Let's start at the beginning here. What is Jordan Peterson's rule number one?
Stand up straight with your shoulders back.
So you're saying 5 million men paid $26 to be told stand up straight with your shoulders back? What is going on here?
That's not all. Rule 12 is pet a cat when you encounter one on the street.
I
see that reduced you to silence.
I'm stunned.
Well, I'm a big cat person, so I'm okay with that one.
I like cats too, but I don't pat them on the street because a lot of them don't want to be patted by strangers.
I know, but Jordan Peterson wouldn't care about that.
It's not about what the cat wants. I looked up the publicity for his new rules, his new book. And according to the publicity, the book has a thesis, which is too much security is dangerous. And that's because, quote, unchecked order can petrify us into submission. I think we have to agree that we do not want to be petrified into submission.
He really has a way with words, doesn't he? But before I forget, I have to say that this book begins with a long, what he calls an overture in his pretentious way, in which he discusses all his physical problems, where he was on this all meat diet, which he was touting that this is just the best thing. Just eat nothing but meat, just meat, 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 meat. And then he became very sick and ended up in a coma in Russia. And he was in this coma, and he was also addicted to various prescription meds. And he talks about this on and on and on. See, people who write these books, How to Live, they very rarely have a lot of self-knowledge. That's probably why they think they can tell everybody else how to live. They're not really paying attention. So he had this whole thing with meat and prescription meds, but nonetheless, you should still do everything he says. I think his basic thing, and I was very soft on him, although it doesn't seem that way because I was having fun and being kind of snarky, but basically it appeals to the kind of rigid anti-woman feelings that some men have, where what they really want is a girlfriend, and yet and they don't understand why they don't have a girlfriend. What's the matter with these horrible women? I hate them. They won't be my girlfriend. So his other rules have to do with things like, okay, work as hard as you possibly can on at least one thing and see what happens. So who could disagree with that?
Who could disagree?
And you could see how somebody's kind of adrift in life that, yeah, I should really find something I like doing and I should try to do it really well. That's good. And then plan and work diligently to maintain the romance in your relationship. Well, this is straight out of a women's magazine, except I love plan and work diligently. That's a sort of militaristic approach to dating. Okay, so the last rule, be grateful in spite of your suffering. And what's interesting about that is that he acknowledges that people suffer. And yeah. I think in America, we're supposed to be happy all the time. And if you have real serious troubles, you keep them inside. And we don't get a lot of acknowledgement of loneliness, of feelings of failure, of all your personal relationships being very difficult, all that. And he says, yeah, of course you're miserable and I'm going to fix you.
Yeah. Well, you know, he does say there's one other revealing thing related to that. The Amazon page for his new book has an excerpt that begins, "Don't do work that makes you contemptuous of yourself, feeling weak and ashamed," close quote. Now, of course, that's great advice, but it's interesting that he is acknowledging what many of his readers feel, that they feel weak and ashamed and contemptuous of themselves. That's pretty radical, as you say, for an American.
It is not very American. It's not very manly. Manly is kind of the opposite of those things, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I think you have a lot of people who feel their life isn't working out and they have to work at a job they hate, and maybe they don't feel they're very good at it, but maybe those two things are related. And because people tend not to be really good at things that they don't enjoy or approve of. Feminists hate Jordan Peterson. Let's just get that on the table. They hate him. And in fact, the publishing company of this book, the hundreds of the young staffers signed a petition, don't publish this.
Oh, man.
That wasn't going to happen, given what his sales figures are. But so he's widely hated on the left and especially by feminists. And I think that's fair. I'm just amazed anybody can get through this book because it's so disastrously badly written. It's so tedious. It reminds me of, like, you probably have had students that postpone their paper until the night before. But the paper is long. It's like you have to write 40 pages. And so they just put in everything they have ever known or thought, everything they have read. And that's where you get all this crazy, you know, Isis and Osiris. I'm sure they can come in here somewhere.
Well, another one that he brings in that I was sort of surprised to see is he has a thing about humans are a lot like lobsters.
Oh, lobsters. Yeah.
What does he mean by that?
You can go to his website and there's all these lobster themed things you can buy, like a necktie, a t-shirt, a cover for your cell phone with these little lobsters. And the t-shirt, I think, says Hail Lobster, maybe that's the hat, Hail Lobster. So the lobster, according to him, is very much like people in the following way, because of some neurological similarity. The fact that lobsters are basically hostile and competitive and territorial means that that's the way people are.
I saw that you mentioned this, and then I Googled what is the lobster personality, and the first thing that came up was, despite their warlike appearance, lobsters are actually sensitive and delicate animals. That's from the website animalsofaustralia.com.
Well, so now I have to feel guilty again for eating lobster rolls. I thought Jordan Peterson was giving me permission to have as many as I wanted.
Then I also found on Google that the Swiss government just passed a law stating people can no longer boil a lobster alive.
I'm gobsmacked. What they'll have to take that famous scene out of Annie Hall. Remember?
my point is he seems to be wrong about lobsters.
And many other things as
well. Many other things.
For example, women. He said,
yes.
In volume two, in the volume I'm discussing, he talks very little about feminism. There's only a couple of mentions because he got into so much trouble in book one talking about them and feminists. And so, but he says, you know, no matter what feminists say, I've seen it time and time again, what women, all women basically want to have children. And I'm thinking, I don't think so. I think a lot of women wanted to have children, but, you know, maybe 80%, but it's not something all women want. But his thing is, okay, all women want to have children. They are being led up the garden path by feminism to focus on their careers. And then wham, bam, it's too late. You know, they've got fertility problems. But another problem they have is men.
This is your view. This is your view.
This is my view, that the men that this book is written for are not really boyfriend material.
Yeah, you say the basic problem Jordan Peterson is addressing is that men are having a hard time getting quality girlfriends and now have to make more of an effort to be what you call boyfriend material. What is the cause of this problem, in your view?
In my view, I think that they haven't really reckoned with, a lot of men haven't really reckoned with feminism and what it requires of them. They still are with the old mindset. And then they're constantly surprised when women put them in the friend zone, for example.
At this point, I think we have to talk about incels, involuntary celibates, one of the most searched terms on Google last year, it turns out. What advice does Jordan Peterson have for incels?
Do not allow yourself to become resentful, deceitful, or arrogant. That's rule 11. It's good advice if you can follow it. But incels love Jordan Peterson. I think there's people like his militarism, his rigidity, his kind of straighten up and fly right, like my father used to say, they want that old, that patriarchal thing. And it's not so easy to find that patriarchal thing in a psychologist, which is what he is. You have to go to, you know, a superhero movie to get that. But now you can have Jordan Peterson.
Okay, you don't think Jordan Peterson is a good source of advice, despite the fact that he sold millions of books and dozens of languages. Have you got anything better to offer as wisdom for how to live these days?
Well, my husband and I have been reading out loud for a very long time Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. Now, I have to say that the classicist I revere, Mary Beard, thinks the Stoics are terrible people. They're fascists. Marcus Aurelius was just a major war maker, which he mentions occasionally in the book. But I feel this book has been guiding people through the struggles of life for over 1,000 years. And unlike Jordan Peterson, it's well-written and it's short. And at the end of my column, I summarize his advice. Okay, rule one. These are better rules than Jordan Peterson's. Rule one, try as hard as you can to be a good, responsible, serious person. Rule two, be aware that much of life is out of your control. You just have to accept that. And rule three, in any case, soon you will be dead.
Soon you will be dead. Katha Pollitt wrote about Jordan Peterson's advice for men in her latest column. You can read it at thenation.com. Katha, I don't care what you say. I'm going to stand up straight from now on.
And shoulders back. Shoulders back.
We spoke with Katha in June 2021.
That's it for today's Living in the USA. Our social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you miss part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at livinginthusapod.com. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and Living in the USA.